For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, folks, let's get started. Ladies, gentlemen, ladies, start your engines. Okay, we're picking it up. Lech Lecha, our in-depth look throughout the Torah. Continuing with chapter 12, verse 10. Where we last left off, Avram fulfills, you know, one of his tests, and does the Lech Lecha, right, completely cut off. And he goes to Mitzrayim, he goes to Egypt, he goes to Eretz Yisrael, and there's a famine, and now he's headed for Egypt, right? And again, for those new people, this is the point where Nachmanides, Rambam, brings down Kol Mash Ira L'Avos Ila Labonim. Everything that happened to the fathers happened to the children. Masi Avos Simon Labonim. This is such a clear example, the Exodus in miniature. Okay, we went down because of the famine in both examples. They had designs on the women in both examples, right? They wanted to kill the males. Here, they want to kill Abram. There, they want to kill the firstborn males. They were hit with plagues in the big Exodus by Sarim, Meno, Paro's hit with plagues here, and they're chased out with great wealth. Okay. So, we'll pick it up. Verse 10. Vehi Rav Ba'aretz. There's a famine in the land. Now, Vehi always, is like behold, right? I guess that's the way they translate it. Does anybody know why this class is designed to open up for questions, to take our time? So anything you want, you know, discuss, please, this is the opportunity. Vayehi Rav Ba'aretz. By the way, I gotta apologize for this. This is strictly, you know, I always feel bad doing this. I don't want to make anybody feel bad. This is strictly a voluntary basis. There's absolutely no reason to give. I have to ask you mechila in case I ever do this and it embarrasses anybody. Okay, sorry, but, okay.
I have a question.
Yes. Well, that's very good. Two things on this word. Vayihi, there is always a, and it's attached to the thing previous, usually. Interesting, there's a parsha break here. You see the pay? There's a parsha break, which means usually this is a new Indian, a new subject matter, but Vayihi connects it. Now, we discussed in the class, Vayihi and Vahaya, the Gemara, I believe it's in Megillah, says whenever the words Vayihi is used, Lashon Tzara. It's a language connotating sorrow. Bad. Like, Vayihi b'yamei Achashverosh. The Gemara gives an example. It wasn't the time of Achashverosh. You know the Purim story. And then, of course, there was a decree on the Jews, right? And so we analyzed this a few times. If you remember in B'Shalach, in the Parsh B'Shalach, Vayihi B'Shalach Paro, and Paro sent the people. Why was it used there? That seems like something good. Right? We discussed this a few times. And Vahaya is the opposite. Lashon Simcha. It connotates something good. That is the general rule. Okay? Vayihi and Vahaya. Okay? And there's some discussion about Vayihi, if it's with another word just by itself. But that's what it connotates. And of course here, there's a famine land. Avram has been teaching people certain things, get rid of their idols, and they did. And Avram kind of looks bad, if you will, because the people are saying, look, you know, there was never a famine. That's what I started to say at the beginning. Vayihi means behold, like something new has happened. Vayihi ra'av ba'aretz, behold, there's a famine, the first ever. No such phenomenon before. So imagine, you never experienced that before. You know, and there's a famine, and everything's been fine. So you would think, well, let's look into this. What has been different this year you know, recently, that could possibly cause this phenomena known now as a famine? Well, the only thing that's been different is this guy comes to us with his shrimal and payas and tells us to get rid of our idols. Must mean that's exactly opposite what we're supposed to do, Halila. Right? I got the idols are mad and there's a famine in the land. So as a language of sorrow, it kind of made for temporarily, very temporarily, Avram look bad. Right? If nothing else, all these tests, amongst everything else, teach us that what looks temporarily like something disastrous always turns out for the best. And here too, this looks disastrous going down to Egypt, and what happens? Avram's name spreads throughout the world because Egypt, which was master in Kishuf, witchcraft, black magic, there used to be legitimate science. Bilam knew it, right? Balak knew it. Lavan was a master at it, okay? So no one ever, you know, was able to get out of Egypt, you know, was able to get anything over Egypt or Paro. And Avram left there and was showered with gifts and was considered like a prince, you know, like no one messed with him. They gave him a very famous name throughout the world. You see this many times. You know, if you look at Hanukkah coming up, you look at the Hanukkah story, how, you know, we just look at that one last battle, but there was many battles leading up to Hanukkah. And over and over again, Matityahu's son, Yehuda, who led everybody, was vastly outnumbered, and it looked disastrous. And they fasted, and they went to Sheol. Like, that's how Jews go to war. They weaken themselves physically, because they understand that's not the source of power. You know, they fast themselves and straighten themselves spiritually, even though that may weaken themselves physically, because the physical is irrelevant. And these huge 60,000, 70,000 armies, and Yehuda was like less than 10,000. Over and over again, he's victorious, and it looks disastrous. And what comes from that? A tremendous victory, and it put fear in all of Antiochus' men. So again, I'm just giving an example. This is related to by the Navi. Es sarhi Yaakov umemena yivashaya. From a troubled time to Jacob, Jewish people. And from it, they will be saved. So the Sfasema says, from the Tzara, Umemena, will come the salvation. From the very decree, from the very source, will come the salvation. We gave the example, Paro, edict, you know, decree, to throw the Jewish male babies in the river, disastrous. From it came the salvation, because what happened? The righteous convert, Basya, right, which means daughter of God. Basya, the daughter of Paro, tremendous, she became a convert. She took Moshe Rabbeinu out of the river. Paro raised him. He raised the Redeemer. He raised his destruction. So from the Gufu, from the Tzara comes the Yeshua. From the Tzara comes the salvation. Okay? So here again, Avram looks terrible. Famine has to go down to Egypt. But because of this so-called quote-unquote disaster, Gamzu L'Toiva, right? That's the key three words. From here comes his fame spreads. And not to mention the physical wealth, which we're going to see is a big question why Avram took the physical wealth and why that's really important. Avram really didn't care about physical wealth. He used it properly, certainly. But we'll have to explore that. Okay, so that's what it is. But he robbed ours. It was a famine land. Behold, the very first one. Supposed to be 10 famines in the world, says the Medrash. The last one will be spiritual. The prophet, the Navi, the prophet says it will be a famine and it won't be for bread, it won't be for water to drink, but for Devar Hashem, for the word of God, a spiritual famine. 10 famines. Okay. So, V'yah, Baraz, there was a famine land, V'yayred, Avram, Mitzrayim, and V'yayred. He went down to Egypt. Anytime you leave Israel, it's a Yerida. You're going down. I don't care if the country you're going to is a mountain. You're going down. And also the opposite. Anytime you go to Israel, what do we call it? Aliyah. Right. And I'm trying to find it. When it says he went to Egypt, it uses that word. Here it is. It's chapter 13, verse 1, after the whole Egyptian episode. Bayal Avram in Mitzrayim. Avram made Aliyah. He went up spiritually. Anybody who goes to Israel is going back to their true roots, their true self, and therefore is making Aliyah. And so So Avram goes out of Mitzrayim here. We're back in verse 10. Lagur sham. Very key words. Very key words. Lagur sham. Anybody know why these are such important words? Important, because they say there's three reasons why you're allowed to leave Israel. If you live in Israel, it's not so simple that you can leave. If you think, you know, for the sake of finding a shidduch, you know, okay, that's a legitimate reason. For parnasa, a famine, that's considered parnasa sustenance, that's a legitimate reason. Or you feel that learning Torah at a certain place will be better for you, you have a certain connection, right, with a certain Rebbe or something. That's the third, only three reasons that you're allowed to leave. Now, so it's making it very clear, if you have to leave, right, it's lagur. It's just a temporary sojourn wherever you're at. This ain't home. And no matter how nice it is, it can be Mitzrayim, the most cultured, civilized place in the world at the time, by the way. Well, it's very cultured. I don't know about civilized or very moral. However, Avram went down with the fact, I have to go down because of Parnassa, you know, because of the famine. I'm just going to be a ger here. And then the end of the verse explains it. He covet hara'av ba'aretz. Only because it was a severe famine am I allowed to leave the Halakha Kedushas of Eretz Yisrael to go down out of town. Stop, we'll take questions. Could be that for a ger, it's strange for him, you know, at the beginning. I think the commandment, they have to say, ger, to love the convert or the ger, is repeated 36 times in the Torah. However, there's different commentaries. It's not only going not only on a convert, but any stranger that comes to your town, right? You should love them, make them feel welcome, you know, especially at the beginning, a person has no friends, you know. So that word lagur, to be a temporary sojourner, and a ger, a stranger. I just guess when a person first comes to town, he's not comfortable. He doesn't fit. Doesn't feel like he fits in. He's not settled in. So he's like a stranger. He's like a wanderer. So a convert to Judaism. Your question is very good, because a convert, I guess at the beginning, it's uncomfortable for him. But you're supposed to make him feel welcome, and you're never supposed to mention his past. But maybe that's a praise to them. Maybe it's a praise. You know, look where this person was and look where he came. It says the Kodesh Baruch Hu has a certain love for converts, you know, that, like, you know, we were born into it, right? And this person, you know, he came to me. That's why Basia was called Basia. You took in a son that wasn't yours. I'm going to call you my daughter. You know, it's a tremendous thing. So, yeah. Verse 11. Vayi kasher kriv levo Mitzrayima. And behold, when he came close to coming to Mitzrayim, again, that word of sorrow. Why would it be a word of sorrow here? What is the connotation here? Vayomer el Sarah, Yishai said to Sarah's wife, behold again, na yadati. Behold, now I know, ki isha yefas mara at. You're a very pretty woman. Now, there's a big debate on this, by the way. There's a difference evident between Yefas Mare and Yefas Toar. That's the description of Rachel Imenu. And one has to do with, I think, form, one has to do with facial. Sara Imenu is one of the four most beautiful women that ever lived. Why is that important? I'll tell you in a couple minutes. What I started to say is there's a debate on this whole. Obviously, the big question on this verse is, how did Avram not know that Sarah was not beautiful? You got to understand something about modesty. Okay, it's true, it could be modesty, but about humility and modesty, these things, it's not sometimes what we think it is. I mean, humility is a very good example. For example, Moshe Rabbeinu knew who he was. It's not humble to be a great prophet and say, oh, I'm a nothing. That's just stupid, you know? That's false humility. Moshe Rabbeinu knew who he was, right? He knew he had a prophecy like nobody else. So what was his humility? His humility, he realized the source, right? That's the key. To realize no matter what you have, whether it's beauty, whether it's riches, whether it's wisdom, whatever it is, that has nothing to do with me. I'm just a keli. I'm just a vessel. Of course, Baruch Hu could have given it to anybody. That's the definition. Now, the reason Oh, so I started to say, so there's a debate here whether Avram really didn't know she was modest. Rashi brings all this down because they were so, what did I say? She did, excuse me, Avram didn't know that she was beautiful because they're so modest. Or he knew, but now it became like relevant. Let's look at the Rashi inside, verse 11. Midrash Agada. Ad achshav lo ikir ba mitoch snias shebishneyam. Until now, he didn't recognize her beauty because they were very modest people. Okay? Vakshav ikir ba. Now he recognized it. Aide maisa. Over a certain incident, they were passing through a river, and sorry, Manel had to lift up her skirt a little bit, her ankle was exposed or something, you know. And he saw, you know, or he saw her reflection in the water, I think it was another Medrash brings, whatever, he saw that she was very beautiful. Okay, so that obviously was from Hashem also to be on guard for these people who are very lustful and very immoral people, the Egyptians, to take precautions. Davar Elcher, a different thing, says Rashi. Min haga oilam sha'al yedei teirach aderach adam misvaze. No, says Rashi. And, you know, really, Avram knew that Sarah was beautiful. No doubt about it. But usually when people travel, you know, it's very wearing on a person. You don't look so great when you've been traveling, you know, a few days, right? Probably getting very little sleep and this and that. But, so, that's the usual. The Zeis Amda Biofia, but you know, Sara Mano stayed beautiful looking, even through the traveling. She was exceptional. Okay, that's the second thing. Now, a third, Upshuta Shomikra, the simple meaning of the verse is the following. Hine na higia sha shiesh lidayag ayafiecha. Now it's come the time. I always knew you were beautiful, but now comes a time where it's really like relevant. It's time to worry about your beauty because you're so beautiful. You know they're going to take you. Okay, yadati ze yamim rabin kiyapas marat. I knew for a long time, obviously, that you're beautiful. Bakshav anu boim ben anoshim shechayrim. But now we're going to people that are black, umukarim. They're ugly. Achim shalkushim, the brothers of the Negroes. Below her galu beishas yafa, they're not used to seeing a beautiful woman. Okay, so therefore the following scheme: say you're the sister, right? The Medrash goes in detail by saying that you're my sister and that you're looking for your husband. So the Egyptians had a warped sense of morals. They knew there were seven mitzvahs of Noah. Okay, and one of the mitzvahs of the seven mitzvahs of Noah is you're not allowed to have illegal relationships, adultery. Also, you're not allowed to kill, murder. And that's what Avram was also concerned about. Two things, that he'd be murdered and she'd be subject to a fate worse than death. Right? So again, what does it help Sam, the brother? In other words, let's go back to the original premise. Why is it Avram, if you're worried, if you say that she's a married woman and the husband's not around, I'm the husband, right? You're not worried, you know, they'll kill me and they'll marry you, right? So say you're my sister, right? In other words, the Egyptians reasoned the following. It's true that we're not allowed to murder, right? But it's better to murder once than to live with her every day we'd be sinning. So we'll just sin once. They made like a whole marketing thing out of their sins. Right? Okay, we'll have one sin on our account. But then, you know, we get, you know, following pleasure, whatever. Well, if we don't kill the husband, every time, you know, we're with her, it'll be a sin. So it's better we kill once, sin once, than sin many times. Fakumta, kind of a very good question. So, it says actually in the verse that I'll get the custom. We have to understand what their custom was. Custom was a family member, they would shower them with lavish gifts. They had a certain decorum. They had, like, of course, they were evil and corrupt, even the Nazis. There was a certain, like, if they had a decree, they would follow it. That's why it says in Pirkei Avos, you should always pray for the benefit of the government. Because without the government, people are at each other's throat. Even a corrupt government. Because they're, you know, it's not Hefker. Everybody doesn't do whatever they want. At least there's some boundaries. So their boundaries, even though, yeah, they're immoral, they do terrible things, but their tradition was they would shower this lady's relatives with gifts, you know, and try to get him to give her in a legitimate way. If he didn't, then, you know, to take her anyways. But, okay, that was number one. The other thing is she was also told, it doesn't mention in the verse, but the Medrash brings down that she was told that I'm looking for my husband. It's my brother helping me look for my husband. Now, that really secured the fact Avram, they're not going to kill, not the husband. Doesn't know anything good to kill him. We still can't live with her. The husband's missing. We better treat him nicely. They're trying to find the husband. Once we find the husband, we'll take care of him. In the meantime, we need everybody's help. That was the scheme. And Avram did this always in their travels, says Rashi. And Yitzhak repeated it. And it only mentions it here because it becomes important. It mentions it also with Avimelech for the incident with Tisa. Now, make no mistake about it, this was a test within a test that Sari Menu was abducted. Okay? Yeah. About, you know, people that think some of the biggest anti-Semites, we've been taught anti-Semitism from our own Torah before we came Orthodox. They got that Yaakov was a con artist that he thought, how could he take advantage of his brother, the murderer, rapist, Esav, and sell him the birthright for a bowl of beans? How could the brothers sell their own brother Yosef? How could David do adultery, which he never, never did? You know, because they don't know Torah. They don't believe in the oral tradition. They don't believe in the Talmud. This is a closed book. They're hypocrites. Because in the secular world, they believe in an oral tradition, or they never would take an aspirin in their lives. So what is it? They say things to feed their own ego. They're telling more about themselves than, obviously, about anything else. They are the type of people that would probably do that. So they can say that Chalila about Avram Avinu. Okay? If Avram Avinu did such a sin, Chalila, he wouldn't repeat it with Avimelech. Avram Avinu, it says in Pirkei Avos, passed all 10 tests. So obviously there's nothing wrong with this. It says, the Medrash says, go, tread a path for your descendants to go there. You're not allowed to rely on a miracle. You're supposed to take all natural precautions possible to the point the Gemara says a person that goes over a shaky bridge, his life's in jeopardy. Not because he went on a shaky bridge, because if a miracle happens for him, he gets taken away from his merits. And if it doesn't happen for him, right, then it's like he committed suicide. You're not allowed to rely. I don't care who you are. You're not allowed to rely on miracles. Okay? And if this was wrong, why would Yitzchak repeat it? Okay? So, it's very aggravating to hear this stuff because it's just absolute apikorsis. Genuine, 100% apikorsis. Complete heresy. First of all, even that doesn't get off the ground. If you say that the Torah is written by man, it's a very inconvenient book. What would the Torah, no other book of history, if you consider it a book of history, would write about its own people in the desert. You sin, you've been murmurers, right? You're terrible, you worship idols. No other people in the world would write just disgraceful things about their past, like brothers selling another brother. Or, you know, it's a very, no one writes in their history that we were slaves. You know, in Egypt, no one wants to admit to those things. So in other words, if it was written by man and we wanted to lie, we could have done a lot better. So it's a very inconvenient thing. The bottom line is these people make no mistake about it. No matter how sincere and humanity and liberal they seem, they got one agenda. Either their honor, their money, desires. And they'll do anything to achieve that agenda. Make no mistake about it. And there's two ways to do that. And one of the best ways to do it is putting other people down. And if you put the great people of the quote-unquote Bible down, then that gives you license to do whatever you want to do. Because look, the great Avram, you know, did it, right? That's what's really in the back subconscious. Yes. The place was corrupt. Canaan, the land of Canaan where Israel is, extremely corrupt. Egypt and Canaan are described as the two most corrupt places in the world. Right? Sodom was there. Right? Was destroyed. Egypt was extremely immoral. When the death of the firstborn, the last of the plagues, even, we're talking about 400 years later, it says there was several deaths in every household. Because every household had several children from this, the woman of the house had several partners. So this was the firstborn from this guy, this was the firstborn from this guy, and same thing with the guy. So like every house of Egypt could have 6, 7, 8 people dead because they're all firstborns from different spouses, from different people. Everybody was doing everything with everybody. We're talking about completely immoral, corrupt people. And we're going to see this very clearly when Avram later rebukes and Avram says, what made you do this? He asks you a question. And he says, because I see there's no fear of God in this place. Yes, you're cultured. Yes, you're civilized. No fear of God. You can do anything when you get a desire. We'll talk about that later. But basically, the Torah is extremely racist, extremely prejudiced, not towards skin color, towards conduct, towards behavior. That's what the Torah is prejudiced about. If a people show themselves by a certain conduct to be completely amoral people, right, the Torah slams them. That has nothing to do with skin color. Okay. You got to understand something. There was a curse. They came out black for a reason. They were cursed, they were immoral, and they came out black. So it goes hand in hand. Again, the physical always represents the spiritual. The fact that these are black, the brothers of Negroes, they're amoral. The black, just happened not too long ago, right? Remember, Noah and Avram were contemporaries for 58 years. And that son, Ham, came out of the ark, and he was struck with blackness and kinky hair. The Medrash makes it very, very clear. Because it was not allowed to have relations on the ark, and he violated that. And then he further did some wonderful things, like had homosexual relationships with his father and castrated him. It's debate whether it's him or his son, but it's the same fruit. Okay? And that's why they're a cursed nation. Now, what we're going to see, folks, listen up for a second. What you're going to see, whoever's attending the Parsha class, is an amazing example of it doesn't matter. I mean, it does. But you can be from an accursed nation and make yourself blessed. Individually, it's a perfect democracy. And we're going to see this with Eliezer, Avram's servant, which he could have been. He could have been Ethiopian or whatever, African, Negro, black, whatever the latest term is. But he really worked on himself. And that's a very, very big lesson. Anybody could work on themselves. I don't want to give it away. But that's a very big lesson about this week's Torah portion. Okay? So, yes. You're born with, you know, you're a cursed nation and this and that. But individually, anybody can make anything of themselves.
This is Farrakhan's
biggest thing. I got news for you. That's not Farrakhan's biggest thing, no matter what it was. If that was never mentioned and never knew about it, he'd find something else. Because an anti-Semite doesn't need a reason. If he hates a Jew, he'll, you know, this is a classic, it says, Halacha yibiyadua Esav sonas Yaakov. It's a halacha. Unbelievable. Esav, the Western world, whatever, the Goyim, hate Yaakov, the Jew. Halacha, you know what a halacha is? Halacha means there's no rhyme or reason for it. God said it, and that's it. It's halacha. The halacha of anti-Semitism is, it doesn't matter. In one place, the Jews are wealthy, so they accuse them of being capitalists. They hate them for that. Other times, they're poor in a different country. They're parasites, so they hate them for that. If nothing else around our history has shown, it doesn't matter what the Jew is, what it is. If they want to be an anti-Semite, they'll make up a reason. So that's an old crock. That's the oldest crock in the world. It's a very convenient handle for an excuse for me to hate the Jew. Right? I have a better question for you. Name me one black leader who says one thing to discredit Farrakhan. Who is an admitted racist by everybody, maybe one person who stands up and says what he's doing is terrible, what is wrong. Not one black leader will stand up. That'll give you a position of where the black community is. Moving on. Okay. Avram, we're going to have a big question here. We're going to get to it in this next verse. And it's a question that was asked me by Schiffer, actually, earlier. Okay, verse 12, I jumped a page, it's about three verses. Verse 12, Vayakir Isaka Mitzrim, the Amru Ishto Zais. The Egyptians will see you and say, you know, this is his wife, Vahargo Isiko Isak Yichayu, and they'll kill me, right? They'll kill me and they'll let you live for a fate worse than death. Okay? If there anything is going to be emphasized in every class that I'm Zaycha to give, is that we have no right to question the great people of the Torah. We have absolutely no conception what they were about. They were not full of the petty jealousies and lusts that we are. We're going to see incidences, for example, with Rachel and Leah in a week in the Parsha class, where the outside world had two jealous sisters. Chas v'shalom. Those people have to do tshuva. These are two tremendously righteous women who had only one thing in mind, and that was to build up the nation of Israel. And so we're going to see this time and time again. Avram, everything he does has nothing to do with him. He only does it for the sake of his his descendants. And again, you know, if you want to, you know, you take one incident and distort it, it's amazing. But if you look throughout the whole history of what Avram does, you know, and you ignore that, you ignore how he sits there and eulogizes his wife in this parsha, and how he had to buy at an exorbitant price a burial plot for her, right? Ignore all these other things, and you ignore how, you know, you could take anything in the Torah if you want, and if you're for crumped, if the person's from crumped, he can try to from crumped the words of the Torah to come out with his pshat. Your mind was on. I forgot to talk. Yeah, when we talked about the physical beauty, we have to go to that. Right? Said four most beautiful women that ever lived. One of them was Sarah. Very amazing. Now, there is something to physical beauty, especially for a female. But listen to this: Sarah, Esther, Abigail, and Rahab were the four most beautiful women that ever lived. Okay. And the Medrash says an interesting thing. There's four people whose coinage, they minted coins, was accepted throughout the world. Abraham, Mordechai, David HaMelech, and Yoshua. Now, that's the truth. Now, what I'm telling you now is also the truth, that these four were married to these four women, which is like interesting to me. Now, Mordechai was married to Esther, right? David HaMelech was married to Abigail. Yoshua was married to Rahab. She was a righteous convert. And Avram, of course, was married to Sarai. It's very interesting. These four coinage, they were very wealthy men, right? Were accepted throughout the world. And yet these four ladies were the most beautiful. So I wanted to say, I don't know if it's true. I mean, the concept is true, that I guess the reason the Medrash is telling this is this is the way you're supposed to use beauty, and this is the way you're supposed to use wealth. Because these great tzaddikim, right, especially Sarai Imenu, used it. You know, there's something about not dressing schlumpy. You know, you take it in guests, you know, Baal Tshuva, so you dress nice, things look nice, the place looks nice, right? It's like a hiddur mitzvah. So, right, so the ladies here use their beauty, right, for a very positive purpose. As a matter of fact, there's one person whose beauty is not mentioned. She was beautiful, Dina. Whose beauty is not mentioned because it became her downfall. For some slight mistake she made. Unbelievably slight. A lack of sneeze on her part. And like, it's an amazing, if you look into it. But anyway, so these, they use their beauty properly. And these men, right, they use their wealth properly. Right, Avram, we know the famous stories of his tremendous hospitality and how he used to feed them, you know, here we have the incident of the three cows. Each one got their own, you know, tongue of a cow and so forth and so on. So this might be representative of pretty much the physical world. You know, beauty, wealth, you know, those are pretty synonymous with the materialistic physical world. So I guess that's what, maybe that's what they're trying to teach us, or how we're supposed to look at the physical world. Yes, it's good. We don't shun away from it. Use it as a tool, as a means to an end, right? It can be very, very, very positive. It's used a lot. Whenever it describes someone's very attractive, Mara, Yafes Mara, pretty to look at. I guess you'd literally translate it. But we got to combine something else into it, and that is, if Sarimane was physically beautiful, there's a reason for that. It is a reflection. It's not just merely, it's a reflection. You know, like we just said the opposite with the Mitzrim being the brothers of the Kushim are ugly and they're black. That's no coincidence. Right? If she was physically beautiful, it must mean spiritually she was beautiful. If Rachel Imenu was physically, right, there's something to it. Yosef, which is going to tell you a little about something about Yosef. Yosef is the only person described in these terms. He's described just like his mother is, which are very feminine terms. So, and he's known as Yosef HaTzadik. I'll tell you something. The Torah's not interested that he's just a physical, beautiful specimen, right? The Torah's not interested that Rachel Imenu was beautiful and Rachel was beautiful, right? That Esther was beautiful. Okay, but it's a reflection. It is a reflection of what they're spiritually about, yes? What I wanted to say is maybe some of just the physical aspect of her beauty was to show how to use that properly in attracting people into Yiddishkeit. You know, for people on a lower level, they need to see that wealth. They need to see that beauty. That, you know, they have the depiction of the Jew who, you know, all year long is Tisha B'Av by him and he's wearing shabby clothes and, you know, the wife is slumping around with something that doesn't, you know, fit her. Like, okay, so for those type of people on that kind of level that just see the chitzonius, just see the outside of things, they need to see this. The truth is, though, there's something legitimate to it. We have this idea of hidur mitzvah, of beautifying a mitzvah, and buying a nice esrog box for the esrog, or something, Shabbos clothes, right? Right? With mitzvah of yontif for a lady, supposed to have new clothes or new jewelry. So, you know, there's something to that, to beautifying the mitzvah. And these people, their whole lives was a mitzvah, right? Their whole life was spirituality. So the beauty and the wealth was a hidur mitzvah. I mean, that's what I wanted to say. I didn't see it anywhere, but I would think that's true.
Also, the
thing is brilliant. It's the bracha that Noach gave Yophis, which
right.
is Greek, to dwell in the tents of Shem.
Right.
You hit Hanukkah right on the head. The Greeks want to do just the opposite. Right. Just have the beauty for itself. Save
so
that.
So there's certain Jews that achieve that.
Right.
The majority don't.
Right. That's, you're very right. Rabbi Yehuda Nossi, you know, had a tremendous wealth. Right, and he himself didn't really participate too much in that wealth, but he used it. Amongst the Hasidic circles, there are some that were very poor, and then there are like the original Rebbe, who wore like it was very elaborate his court, and he believed that this was like Malchus. He was like a kingdom, and it was incumbent on him to look like a king as a Hasidic Rebbe, and so forth and so on. Though inside. He said, like, for example, he didn't wear socks. He had, like, gold-plated shoes, but no socks, because he remained humble inside. This is what David HaMelech is all about, you know, and the kingdom. David HaMelech represents humility to its fullest. But yet, it was demanded of him to show a certain air of a kingdom. And right, and he had to do that. It was against his nature, right? So because you're representing, you're God's ambassadors on earth. More so with the kingdom of David and Judah. So you have to put on airs, not because of who you are, but what you represent. As Jews, we are, mamleches kohanim, right? We are, right? We're all royalty here. We all got blue blood going through our veins, and that's why you keep hearing me harp about Yiddish stolz. You gotta be proud that you're a Jew, and you should look nice, right? And the goyim out there should look up to us, right? Because nothing to do with who, the etzem who we are, but it is the etzem who we are, because the etzem who we are is a representative of God on earth. So it's His kavod, not ours, that we're concerned about. Hashem's honor and glory that we represent. Right. Okay. You can't make a blanket statement like that. That's not true. Especially in this town. How can you say, especially in this town, where you got a shul, Beth Jacob, that's beautiful inside, with elaborate things, from Torah coverings to everything else. You cannot make a, if I would make a statement like that about a certain race of people, you guys would accuse me of being prejudiced. But yet, you guys can get away with saying a blanket statement like that. I don't think you can't say that. You cannot say that.
But us, I think we neglect ourselves physically.
I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. I don't think you can make that blanket statement. I think there's more concern now about this, physicality, and that's why you have a shul upstairs the way it is, and not a little shtiebel, especially in this town. And there's no a true Orthodox Jew, right? On Shabbos, he outdresses anybody. On Yom Tov, right? We outdress anybody. We eat the finer foods than anybody. And we, when it comes, no one. Part of this is tzedakah. You know, you just don't look at what we've davened in. Look at what we put out. And even non-Orthodox Jews, even though going to the wrong causes, they don't know better. But no one gives materialistically of their time and their money than the Jew. And I'm not just talking, I mean more so the Orthodox Jew. The chesed that we do, own ambulance service in New York, the Bikur Cholim, loan funds, everything else. This is also part of it. This is also part. It has a tremendous tremendous, no one gives like us. And even those people who are not involved in Torah, and they think they're giving the right causes, Nebuch, they don't know better, whatever, you know, but they still, you don't find anybody that gives time, effort, concern, money, like the Jew. And this is part of it. And appearances, you know, it's, well, it that's a very dangerous thing. And I don't hold it's true. And I think if you look at anybody else, you could say that much more about those people than us. But we're more sensitive. We're more critical of ourselves. So if we see one person not dressing right, we tend to slam our whole people. And I think it's about time we stood up and give ourselves a pat on the back. Because I think we're doing great. And I think Atlanta, Georgia is a very good prime example of that. What this town looked like 10 years ago and what this show was built and how it's built and everything about it. To me, it's beautiful. I think it's mamish beautiful. I think it's using the materialistic in the right perspective and has brought a lot of people into Yiddishkeit who otherwise would have had this stigma that you're mentioning. They see a beautiful show and they're very attracted to it. So, I'm going to be careful. Anyways, we're going to, any other questions? We have about 3 more minutes. Okay. Okay, so they went down to Mitzrayim. She's very pretty. Again, that word, Mrs. Cortell, to help you out a little bit, Mar'eh, it's from the word re'eh, to see. Re'eh. And by the way, just as interesting, you know, it says a roya. One of the words for roya is a seer. A seer, like a prophet. A seer. S-E-E-R. A roya. I think they said about Shmuel Novi that he was a roya. He could see the inner depths of things. So there's a lot of connection to the spiritual and physical here. You know? Part of it, there's a mitzvah of Yira. There was a mitzvah to go up on 3 festivals to the base of Migdash. To see, to literally see the temple and, you know, all doing on. And that would instill a person with Yiras Hashem. The same word, yes, with fear of God. By seeing, experiencing the temple. By the way, there was nothing as materialistic, if you will, in the right purposes at the temple. With the golden menorahs and the golden vessels and everything. And therefore our shuls, which is a replica of that, you know, we usually, you don't see anything in our shuls that, you know, you gotta be very careful. You don't want to make it gaudy. You know what I'm saying? There's a very fine line between using, the materialistic, the wealth, and dressing up your shul to make it very nice and being ostentatious and losing the whole spirituality. Very good. Thank you. And losing the whole spirituality of it. It's like a real balancing act, you know. It says, like, for example, a Talmud Chacham, a scholar. This is in the Gemara. You know, a scholar, if he has some dirt, a stain on his clothes, he's like, it says terrible things. You're not allowed to do that. You should have clean clothes. But then it goes in detail. It says, you know what? You shouldn't wear really, you know, real elaborate garments. That's not good either. Because that's all considered haughty, conceited, right? But on the other hand, you shouldn't wear a schleppy clothes. You should wear nice clothes. So the Gemara addresses these things. And, you know, so that's important. Okay. So I better quit wearing the same tie. Okay. Yes, Mr. Cortell. By the way, one more thing we should know, but Avram journeys down there. We learn from here that you can leave the land of Israel for a famine. This statement, Masi Avo Sim Labonim, which we've repeated, right? And we're going to repeat. Because it'll come up over again. Literally, besides all the other aspects of it, it is a sign, Simon Labonim, it is a sign for the children how to act. Masi Avo Simon Labonim, by how our forefathers acted, it's a sign for us how to act, what to do. You understand? By studying their lives, and that's what this class is about, to study in detail their lives, how they did things, right? They're the primers of conduct. Teaches us exactly how to do things. And here we learned, you can leave for an Egypt. You're not mad at me that I slammed you about that. It wasn't you per se. I took it out on you.
Personal.
Okay. You know I'm an arrogant asshole. Okay. Moving on. Thank you for taking it off. By the way, it's very interesting. We'll get to this later, but all the patriarchs were named by God. Just an interesting side note. Avram's name was changed by Hashem himself, Avraham. And it says specifically, last week, right, name him Yitzchak, and you shall call him Yitzchak, right? And then Yaakov, right, Hashem himself changes his name to Yisrael, right? You also be called by Yisrael. So that's very interesting in itself, and our name represents a mission, we said. So Avram goes to Avraham, Sarai goes from Sarah, means no one else does this. I mean, this is amazing. You know what that means? It means they were so great, they accomplished their mission, and they got another one. They got another, you know, that's what it means to get a new name. So Yaakov Yisrael.
It's true of the convert.
Yes,
100%,
100%. They get a new name, yeah. New mission, right? New soul. Very nice point. Very good point. When someone's in real, it's not just sewers, it's someone's like on their deathbed. As a last desperate measure, if you will, I don't like to use the word desperate because we don't believe in being desperate. Even if the sword is on our necks, we don't give up. But we change the name because it's a change of destiny, it's a change, you know, it's a whole spiritual cosmic thing there. Yeah, it could be, yeah. And sometimes, you know, that works. He's a different person now. That person no longer exists, right? It's a different entity, yeah. 100%, that can happen. A soul can get another mission. We learn Pinchas, all of a sudden, during his lifetime, got the souls of Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron that died previously. He got their souls, and he suddenly accomplished their mission. Right, in his lifetime. So, yeah, it's true. There is such a thing as a Gilgal reincarnation. I don't know anything about Kabbalah, but there is such a thing. It's, even during your lifetime, you can get another soul. And it says a person gets to greatness, right, to such a degree that he could get certain assistance from certain great tzaddikim, their souls of past generation. That's very heavy-duty stuff. Yes, go ahead. Big question we're going to have. I'm going to leave you with this question. This was Shifra's question. When this is all said and done, Avram is going to take wealth. He's going to take a tremendous amount of wealth, right, out of Egypt. And yet, we're going to see later, God willing, with Saddam, he refuses to take anything. Why here did he take, right, and why there did he refuse? Something to think about. There's several answers to it, okay? So think about that, and we'll meet next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.